As Xenophanes remarked 25 centuries ago, men always make their gods in their own image. But to this, television politics has added a new wrinkle. Those who would be gods refashion themselves into images the viewers would have them be. And so, while image politics preserves the idea of self-interest voting, it alters the meaning of self-interest. Big Tim Sullivan and my father voted for the party that represented their interests, but interests meant to them something tangible: patronage, preferential treatment, protection from bureaucracy, support for one's union or community, Thanksgiving turkeys for indigent families. Judged by this standard, blacks may be the only sane voters left in America. Most of the rest of us vote our interests, but they are largely symbolic ones, which is to say, of a psychological nature. Like television commercials, image politics is a form of therapy, which is why so much of it is charm, good looks, celebrity, and personal disclosure. It is a sobering thought to recall that there are no photographs of Abraham Lincoln smiling, that his wife was, in all likelihood, a psychopath, and that he was subject to lengthy fits of depression. He would hardly have been well suited for image politics. We do not want our mirrors to be so dark and so far from amusing. What I am saying is that just as the television commercial empties itself of authentic product information so that it can do its psychological work, image politics empties itself of authentic political substance for the same reason. It follows from this that history can play no significant role in image politics, for history is of value only to someone who takes seriously the notion that there are patterns in the past which may provide the present with nourishing traditions. The past is a world, Thomas Carlyle said, and not a void of gray haze. But he wrote this at a time when the book was the principal medium of serious public discourse. A book is all history. Everything about it takes one back in time, from the way it is produced to its linear mode of exposition to the fact that the past tense is its most comfortable form of address. As no other medium before or since, the book promotes a sense of a coherent and usable past. In a conversation of books, history, as Carlyle understood it, is not only a world, but a living world. It is the present that is shadowy. But television is a speed of light medium, a present-centered medium. Its grammar, so to say, permits no access to the past. Everything presented in moving pictures is experienced as happening now, which is why we must be told in language that a videotape we are seeing was made months before. Moreover, like its forefather, the telegraph, television needs to move fragments of information, not to collect and organize them. Carlyle was more prophetic than he could imagine. The literal gray haze that is the background void on all television screens is an apt metaphor of the notion of history the medium puts forward. In the age of show business and image politics, political discourse is emptied not only of ideological content, but of historical content as well. Czesław Miłosz, winner of the 1980 Nobel Prize for Literature, remarked in his acceptance speech in Stockholm that our age is characterized by a refusal to remember. He cited, among other things, the shattering fact that there are now more than 100 books in print that deny that the Holocaust ever took place. The historian Karl Schorske has, in my opinion, circled closer to the truth by noting that the modern mind has grown indifferent to history because history has become useless to it. In other words, it is not obstinacy or ignorance, but a sense of irrelevance that leads to the diminution of history. Television's Bill Moyers inches still closer when he says, "I worry that my own business helps to make this an anxious age of agitated amnesiacs. We Americans seem to know everything about the last 24 hours, but very little of the last 60 centuries or the last 60 years." Terence Moran, I believe, lands on the target in saying that with media whose structure is biased toward furnishing images and fragments, we are deprived of access to an historical perspective. In the absence of continuity and context, he says, bits of information cannot be integrated into an intelligent and consistent whole. We do not refuse to remember, neither do we find it exactly useless to remember. Rather, we are being rendered unfit to remember. For if remembering is to be something more than nostalgia, it requires a contextual basis, a theory, a vision, a metaphor, something within which facts can be organized and patterns discerned. The politics of image and instantaneous news provides no such context, is in fact hampered by attempts to provide any. A mirror records only what you are wearing today. It is silent about yesterday. With television, we vault ourselves into a continuous, incoherent present. History, Henry Ford said, is bunk. Henry Ford was a typographic optimist. History, the electric plug replies, doesn't exist. If these conjectures make sense, then in this Orwell was wrong once again, at least for the Western democracies. He envisioned the demolition of history, but believed that it would be accomplished by the state, that some equivalent of the Ministry of Truth would systematically banish inconvenient facts and destroy the records of the past. Certainly, this is the way of the Soviet Union, our modern-day Oceania. But as Huxley more accurately foretold it, nothing so crude as all that is required. Seemingly benign technologies devoted to providing the populace with a politics of image, instancy, and therapy may disappear history just as effectively, perhaps more permanently, and without objection. We ought also to look to Huxley, not Orwell, to understand the threat that television and other forms of imagery pose to the foundation of liberal democracy, namely, to freedom of information. Orwell quite reasonably supposed that the state, through naked suppression, would control the flow of information, particularly by the banning of books. In this prophecy, Orwell had history strongly on his side, for books have always been subjected to censorship in varying degrees wherever they have been an important part of the communication landscape. In ancient China, the Analects of Confucius were ordered destroyed by Emperor Chu Huang Ti. Ovid's banishment from Rome by Augustus was in part a result of his having written Ars Amatoria. Even in Athens, which set enduring standards of intellectual excellence, books were viewed with alarm. In Areopagitica, Milton provides an excellent review of the many examples of book censorship in classical Greece, including the case of Protagoras, whose books were burned because he began one of his discourses with the confession that he did not know whether or not there were gods. But Milton is careful to observe that in all the cases before his own time, there were only two types of books that, as he puts it, the magistrate cared to take notice of: books that were blasphemous and books that were libelous. Milton stresses this point because, writing almost 200 years after Gutenberg, he knew that the magistrates of his own era, if unopposed, would disallow books of every conceivable subject matter. Milton knew, in other words, that it was in the printing press that censorship had found its true métier, that in fact information and ideas did not become a profound cultural problem until the maturing of the age of print. Whatever dangers there may be in a word that is written, such a word is 100 times more dangerous when stamped by a press, and the problem posed by typography was recognized early, for example, by Henry VIII, whose Star Chamber was authorized to deal with wayward books. It continued to be recognized by Elizabeth I, the Stuarts, and many other post-Gutenberg monarchs, including Pope Paul IV, in whose reign the first Index Librorum Prohibitorum was drawn. To paraphrase David Reisman only slightly, in a world of printing, information is the gunpowder of the mind. Hence come the censors in their austere robes to dampen the explosion. Thus Orwell envisioned that 1. Government control over 2. Printed matter posed a serious threat for Western democracies. He was wrong on both counts. He was, of course, right on both counts insofar as Russia, China, and other pre-electronic cultures are concerned. Orwell was, in effect, addressing himself to a problem of the age of print, in fact, to the same problem addressed by the men who wrote the United States Constitution. The Constitution was composed at a time when most free men had access to their communities through a leaflet, a newspaper, or the spoken word. They were quite well positioned to share their political ideas with each other, in forms and contexts over which they had competent control. Therefore, their greatest worry was the possibility of government tyranny. The Bill of Rights is largely a prescription for preventing government from restricting the flow of information and ideas. But the Founding Fathers did not foresee that tyranny by government might be superseded by another sort of problem altogether, namely the corporate state, which through television now controls the flow of public discourse in America. I raise no strong objection to this fact, at least not here, and have no intention of launching into a standard brand complaint against the corporate state. I merely note the fact with apprehension, as did George Gerbner, dean of the Annenberg School of Communication, when he wrote, "Television is the new state religion run by a private ministry of culture, the three networks, offering a universal curriculum for all people, financed by a form of hidden taxation without representation. You pay when you wash, not when you watch, and whether or not you care to watch." Earlier in the same essay, Gerbner said, "Liberation cannot be accomplished by turning television off. Television is for most people the most attractive thing going any time of the day or night. We live in a world in which the vast majority will not turn off. If we don't get the message from the tube, we get it through other people." I do not think Professor Gerbner meant to imply in these sentences that there is a conspiracy to take charge of our symbolic world by the men who run the Ministry of Culture. I even suspect he would agree with me that if the faculty of the Annenberg School of Communication were to take over the three networks, viewers would hardly notice the difference. I believe he means to say, and in any case I do, that in the age of television our information environment is completely different from what it was in 1783, that we have less to fear from government restraints than from television glut. That in fact, we have no way of protecting ourselves from information disseminated by corporate America, and that therefore the battles for liberty must be fought on different terrains from where they once were. For example, I would venture the opinion that the traditional civil libertarian opposition to the banning of books from school libraries and from school curricula is now largely irrelevant. Such acts of censorship are annoying, of course, and must be opposed, but they are trivial. Even worse, they are distracting, in that they divert civil libertarians from confronting those questions that have to do with the claims of new technologies. To put it plainly, a student's freedom to read is not seriously injured by someone's banning a book on Long Island or in Anaheim or any place else. But as Gerbner suggests, television clearly does impair the student's freedom to read, and it does so with innocent hands, so to speak. Television does not ban books, it simply displaces them. The fight against censorship is a 19th-century issue which was largely won in the 20th. What we are confronted with now is the problem posed by the economic and symbolic structure of television. Those who run television do not limit our access to information, but in fact widen it. Our Ministry of Culture is Huxleyan, not Orwellian. It does everything possible to encourage us to watch continuously, but what we watch is a medium which presents information in a form that renders it simplistic, non-substantive, non-historical, and non-contextual, that is to say, information packaged as entertainment. In America, we are never denied the opportunity to amuse ourselves. Tyrants of all varieties have always known about the value of providing the masses with amusements as a means of pacifying discontent. But most of them could not have even hoped for a situation in which the masses would ignore that which does not amuse. That is why tyrants have always relied, and still do, on censorship. Censorship, after all, is the tribute tyrants pay to the assumption that a public knows the difference between serious discourse and entertainment, and cares. How delighted would be all the kings, czars, and führers of the past and commissars of the present to know that censorship is not a necessity when all political discourse takes the form of a jest.